You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, April 21st, 2022. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com, which I guess is obvious in the name of the show. We are now T-minus 9 days from, according to the publishing industry, the start of summer. And the best herald of the start of the summer reading season is our summer preview draft, which you can get and listen to if you're a Book Riot podcast Patreon member, subscriber. I'm not sure what, I guess, subscriber, supporter, patron. That's a tequila, not a person. Patron. So you can go check it out there. We had a really good time recording it, a fascinating reading season to come up. And we're, you know, so today we're recording the next special thing that's going to go in the Patreon feed. Are we going to tell people ahead of time or as a patron? I think I would like to be surprised that something shows up there and they don't know what it's going to be. What do you think about this, Rebecca?
I am just fine with letting what appears in the feed be a surprise, and then we can let folks here know what's available to them if they decide to join us over there with all the folks that have already joined, because once you do join, the backlist becomes available to you as well. Folks are already starting to vote, Jeff, and I won't spoil which way the vote is going.
I'm not going to poison
the water. You know, I believe in a democratic process by the internet. But I will say, interesting single issue voters on both sides.
We're getting that data. We asked explicitly. One of our mistakes in the last preview draft was it was easier to vote. You didn't have to email, but there was no text field. So it was I guess, more like regular voting where you don't explain why you're voting for this candidate versus that. But it was one of the things we thought we learned was that there are single volume voters out there. And that seems to be, are you saying that's bearing up? Is it people are deciding based on one or two votes? There
are some of the votes for me and some of the votes for you that are cited as being tied directly to one or two of the titles that each of us chose.
Okay. All right. Well, now I'm intrigued by knowing a little bit. By not knowing anything, I can pretend it wasn't happening.
Gotta leave them wanting more.
Voting. Yeah, I guess we'll leave voting open for May. There's no reason to close it down as people are listening and deciding to subscribe for the first time. Let's see. We got some feedback to do. I'm not going to say what the next bonus thing that's coming in the feed. When's the next one going to happen?
Tuesday.
For those of you? Tuesday. They're getting another special thing in the feed there. If you missed it last week, you can hear the opening to When the Corn is Waist High by Jeremy Scott after the show. Special thing we're trying. At the end of the show, there's an excerpt. Check out that book there. Listener feedback. I think I have to do the break first. All this could be longer than the pre-break part
I'm
of
ready.
It. So let's do our break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers, and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, And so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
Listener feedback. A couple of emails from folks about our surprise at the shrink wrapping of Atlas of the Heart. That's not a sentence I thought I would say. I guess it's more common than we as the end buyer browsing the table might experience. It makes sense if it's, you know, if it's got inserts, loose leaf, it's oversized. Sure. It keeps it high and tight, as we like to say in the industry, if you shrink wrap the book. So I think the thing that struck me was the shrink wrapping going all the way to the consumer at the end point, right? Mm-hmm. So that it was it was browsable but unflippable. And that seemed to me a key feature of whether or not you should pick this up. And the shrink wrapping element to me thought it was being bought more like a commodity than someone actually deciding whether that's a thing. I want to buy it. I don't even need to look at it in order to buy it there. But apparently it's more common. Maybe this is a weird case of, for some reason, it's just getting left on accidentally indicates sound and shrink wrapping indicating nothing. Atomic Habits. We talked about book sales of the year so far. Atomic Habits is the number one selling book of the year. And one of the things we said there is, isn't it interesting that it's outsold some of the big TikTok hits, even though it's not a TikTok thing. It is a TikTok thing, apparently. Had a couple of people write in to say.
Should have known.
Very carefully and very gently, thank you for my feelings. My feelings, thank you. It's like, actually, this did make the rounds. And in thinking about our conversation there, it's like a 28 title, why all of a sudden is it now? And I think our now prior, Rebecca, has to be.
It's TikTok.
If something all of a sudden now, it's a TikTok thing.
That makes sense. I can adapt this or adopt it into my mental model for what's going on with this book.
It sounds like this one, though, is not a book talk element. It's just the wider people out there on TikTok and you know, the pros and professional development and
biz talk.
This changed my life. Self-dev talk. So it's coming in a little bit sideways. So in what trickles up or down or wherever we are in the waterfall here, it wasn't coming through the book talk. It was people are buying this, but they're seeing it in relation to other kind of. Yeah, it's a tough one. That's a tough audio experience. It's one where you actually see the words. It's not confusing at all, but when you say it. So that was a really fascinating one to see. I thought I had something else to say about that. The big story of the week, and the New York Times has had a couple of recent really good pieces. I've talked about this before. You and I have talked about this before. The feature writing about books on the mm-hmm. New York Times is different than it's been as I can remember it. We got a couple more this week. There's this one, Barnes & Noble went from villain to hero. Then there was a piece today that I didn't have time, and I think you'd seen it, about the experience, trend, habit, industry around books as decoration.
Writ large. Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll get around to that next week. But we could spend a whole episode on this Barnes & Noble piece in the Times. Do you want to do that now or you want to wait?
I think we should wait because it's interesting, but there's not a whole lot of new stuff to it. So I think that we could talk about it.
Hard disagree, but we can talk about it. I've got takes. There's so much of this, Rebecca, happening right now. We could make it our whole podcast feed. I must admit that we've been talking about book bannings and getting stuff pulled off curriculums for so long. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything new to say about any of this, really. It's getting worse, more brazen, and more widespread. Those are all bad things. Is it really philosophically any different than what we've seen before? I don't think so. It's just that, as I think I said on last week's show, that Republicans and a certain kind of conservative person have realized and fully grokked how soft of a target public school libraries and public libraries and reading lists actually are. And I think the other thing that's maybe, it's not good, but it's because of something that's good, is that teachers and librarians and reading list developers and syllabi makers and people who buy the books on the shelves have done an impressive job over the last 5 years getting new books that conservative folks are going to object to, right? I mean, I was looking at these lists of what books are being banned. This stuff wasn't on bookshelves at all. It wasn't even available right. 10 years ago to be banned. I think that's the thing that's remarkable to me is like, mm-hmm. you look at the top 58 books, and I saw a list recently of things that are being banned in Florida, right? 30 of them are explicitly about LGBTQ books for kids and teens, about non-binary gender stuff. And there were like two or three ones that you can fill a list like this that shows up in libraries is a remarkable testament to that's yes. worked and been done all kinds of people. And I'm so sad and angry that now it's going to be defense and pulling and pushback and fighting over these things. So much work has gone in to making these books available for kids who need them that will save their lives in many cases, save their mm-hmm. mental health over many years. And this only hurts libraries. This does nothing good for anyone. And it's very sad to do. And it's going to take people pushing back in their localities. And there's nothing else for it. I'm not sure what else to say, Rebecca. What do you want to add to that, if anything?
Yeah, I think that's all right. And I share all of those feelings and opinions about it. And, you know, I think it's the right framework to think about. This is a response to progress and a response to growth in these areas. You had like the 60s and 70s represented a certain type of political progress. And then we had Reaganism. And then mm-hmm. we moved into the early 2000s and had our first Black president for 8 years and had a lot of progress in both racial and sexual equality. You know, there's certainly a lot of work to do remaining, but made a lot of meaningful progress, a lot of high profile progress. And this is part of the backlash to that. The Trump era was part of the backlash to that. This is continued response to the world is changing in a direction that I don't like. And so let me fight back against it. And you're absolutely right. It's the drum we're going to keep beating that those of us who want the world to keep changing in this direction have to be just as invested in this fight as the people who are trying to stop progress from occurring. I think the notable piece this week was that the book banning has stretched into math textbooks, mm-hmm. that this is not just about protecting the children from a book about gay characters or something that acknowledges, you know, the humanity of a trans person or something like that, but even just references, like small references in like word problems are being, you know, used as reasons to get rid of textbooks. 41% of the math textbooks that were submitted for review in Florida schools have been rejected, either for not meeting some of the new standards or for including quote unquote prohibited topics like critical race theory and social emotional learning. That level of brazenness of and that level, I think this really speaks to how fearful folks on the right are of these things, that you are willing to like to ban a math textbook because, and I don't know what the specific examples were here, but to ban a math textbook because of like what one line in a word problem mentions, that to me is an indication that you know your argument is weak and that it doesn't stand up to scrutiny if you can't subject it to a little exposure to the other side. That's, I think we're just going to continue seeing more of these. A lot of it is because it plays well in PR rolling into the midterms. So the next 6 months are going to be a journey with these kinds of things. But this needs to just be a galvanizing call to action for folks on the left. And even, I think very many moderates. I don't think you need to be as left-leaning as like you or I are to find a lot of things to be worried about with these efforts to remove books from schools, particularly when you're not even talking about real, like I will eat my shorts if there's an actual reference to critical race theory in a Florida elementary school math textbook.
It would be awesome if there were, though. I have to admit, I mean, I would welcome that very much. It's interesting too, because this polls very badly for mm-hmm. Republicans, especially. This is one of those issues that a piece of the edge really, really cares about. I think it's because they don't want gay people to exist, I guess. They don't want non-binary people to exist. And they can't do anything really about their existence and flourishing in the world and their increasing representation and participation in the cultural discourse of American life, all of which are good life-affirming things.
Yes.
But this is what they can do. They can find a weak spot in how our schools are put together, how our country is put together, and where public librarians and teachers have a lot on their plates. They're not paid particularly well. They have a hard enough job getting through the day. And it's very hard to expect and ask them to have the energy, to expend the energy, to come at people that are coming with screeching wheels at them for their jobs and life. Like, we've seen people get fired. We've seen all kinds of stuff. There's legislation coming up now about you could sue a teacher or librarians or press charges for these things. It's not the teacher's job to staff the battlements of culture here. They've got enough to do to get through the day. So it's going to be for the rest of us in our local positions to vote and give money and do other things that we can. And we've seen, you know, when one side rises, the other side does. That's what's happening here. I think a couple of interesting tools to have at your disposal as an interested listener who wants to care about this. One, Danica Ellis wrote for us a story last week about the Brooklyn Public Library making free e-lending cards available from the Brooklyn Public Library. I'm sorry, did I say New York Public Library? Brooklyn Public Library. They're actually different systems, which will give any 13 to 21-year-old in the U.S. access to the BPL's digital resources, 350,000 ebooks and 200,000 audiobooks. Now, caveat, of course, is you need to be able to have some way to look at this stuff, right? You need some sort of technology there. But you can go get one for someone like this. In the Brooklyn Public Library, I will tell you this, it's one of the strongholds of intellectual freedom in this world, I would say. And I've used it a lot myself. It's a wonderful institution. And if you know someone who could benefit from this, please go do this. Here's the statement from Linda E. Johnson. I'll read it real quick. Mm-hmm. President of Brooklyn Library, Public Library, access to information is the great promise upon which public libraries were founded. We cannot sit idly by while books rejected by a few are removed from the library shelves for all. Books Unbanned, that's the name of this project, will act as an antidote to censorship, offering teens and young adults across the country unlimited access to our extensive collection of ebooks and audiobooks, including those which may be banned in their home library. So that's something that the BPL can do. I hope other libraries follow suit. For a long time, I don't know if the NYPL or just the BPL or one of the two, you could get, as any citizen of the country, you could pay a $50 annual fee to access the collection. So they have some extant technology that you don't have to live in, say, Carroll Gardens or the Upper West Side or whatever to access it. They think of themselves, and NYPL, I think, is very much so a national institution. Like the New York Times is a national publication, the NYPL thinks of itself, and I think it really is, the standard bearer, a standard bearer for American public libraries. And the Brooklyn Public Library is certainly like that as well. And I think other people are pivoting. You know, this other story I have here is We Need Diverse Books is offering grants to educators to get the dollars to spend on developing their collections, whatever that looks like, in a library or classroom setting. Some of these situations aren't just about, it could be as soft as we're going to cut your budget so you can't buy stuff. That's a way to do this, even above and beyond the, I'm going to take this particular title off the shelf. But like, if you can get the books into your classrooms, you can get the books into your classrooms. I think that's a very, very wise and self-aware move by We Need Diverse Books part, because it sort of doesn't matter how many diverse books are published if kids that need them can't get them. And there are more books available now than there ever been before. And looking down the supply side, you know, that where the kids can actually get these books, kids and teens and middle grade readers who need this affirmation more than anybody, looking to get the books that exist already into the hands of those kids is now probably more as important as working on the, are there books in the pipeline for the kids even to get their hands on? So I think this is very smart. I hadn't thought about this myself, of how they could, you know, kind of move the ball forward, just like get the titles that are out there into the hands of the kids that could use them.
Yeah, it's really encouraging to see this movement in publishing be mature enough and still a relatively young mm-hmm. movement, but mature enough to be looking all along the supply chain of books, as it were, to not just what's in the pipeline to be published, but how do we make sure that we can provide access to these. Just to expand a little bit more on the Brooklyn Public Library details, they're making a selection of the frequently challenged books available with no wait times for all BPL cardholders. And that includes Black Flamingo by Dean Atta, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones, and Lawn Boy by Rebecca, Jonathan yeah. Evison, among sure others. Happening. I would assume that they've had to do some interesting purchasing of additional copies of these ebook licenses to be able to make this possible for their users. And so monetary investment on behalf that the Brooklyn Library is making on behalf of their readers for this. They're also connecting any of the teens who utilize this special card are going to be connected to the BPL's Intellectual Freedom Teen Council, which provides resources to fight back against censorship and book challenges. So putting the kids sort of directly in touch with the movement to maintain access to these things. And there is, as Jeff was saying, information about how teens can apply for that card in this piece by Danica Ellis, but they can email booksunbanned@bklynlibrary.org, or there's bklynfuture on Instagram, which is an account run by teens. So they'll be messaging their peers. Really cool, which I just didn't know that the Brooklyn Library was doing that they had a teen run even section of Instagram and stuff going on with the teen council. So cool to have a way to really involve users of this service directly into activism that will hopefully make activism like this less necessary in the future.
Link, as always, to all the stories we talk about at bookriot.com/listen. I'm putting this here because I have nothing to say about any of them, but I think it's worth saying even that piece. I always look forward to the list. This is the new, the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honorees, basically some young writers to put some shine on. They're selected by other authors, in this case, Britt Bennett, Chairman Craig, Brian Washington, Elizabeth McCracken, and my thing is getting cut off for my... Rahman Alam. I've only heard of one of these writers. Nathan Harris's The Sweetness of Water was a... I don't have any sense of sales, but I saw it talked about a lot last summer.
I think it was an Oprah pick.
Oh, it was an Oprah pick. Mm-hmm. Well, then maybe the shine already shining for Nathan Harris here. But always, this is a good list to look at. So it's Caleb Nelson, Nathan Harris, Lile, Claire Luchet, and Dantiel Moniz. Go find. This is, if I haven't heard of most of these books, I'm guessing most of the people out there, and I'm always looking for this stuff. And here's the other thing. This is Grove, Hachette, Fantagraphics, Macmillan, Grove. These aren't like tiny European publishers or something. Like these are, if not big five, these are imprints I've heard of. Just goes to show, Rebecca, there are so many books, it's hard to keep track. And I would feel chastened if I didn't know better that, of course, there's some I'm going to heard of. And the reason they pick people like this is so that we'll talk about them. It'll get linked to. Maybe you wouldn't have heard of these books before. I always find this an interesting list. As I've said before, I would like to see the 7 over 70 list as well, especially now that I'm listening to little author named Delia Ephron. Ever heard of her? Left on 10th. You know, our mutual affection for the poetry of the heart from the elderly is a shared wheelhouse of art.
It really is.
But you know, Delia Ephron wouldn't make one of these lists. But there's people that have late in life debuts, and I'm always interested. I'm interested in all of this stuff, I guess, as part of it. But I always like to highlight this. If you've read any of these books and love them, shoot me an email, podcast@bookriot.com.
Yes, please do. Let us know. Yeah, I like how specific this is, that you need to have published your debut novel and only your debut novel.
Yes.
So it's really capturing people early in their careers. And it's a $1,000 prize. So you're right also that this is mostly a publicity effort, which I think is wonderful. Gets people's names out there, gets them talked about. The setup of being chosen by past winners, I also think is very interesting. There's just a lot of, I think, fascinating pieces of this. And previous honorees, there is a good legacy of what yes. kinds of careers the That's folks who point. Win this go on to. Like as you mentioned, Britt Bennett has won in the past, Equica Emezi, Angela Flournoy, Phil Clay, Valeria Luiselli, Taya Obrecht, Karen Russell, Justin Torres, Claire Vay Watkins, Tiffany Yannick, and Charles Yu. And a lot of those are house favorites here on the Book Riot podcast, but also house favorites in reading writ large, and folks who have gone on to have, you know, very well-known and big writing careers. I always think the National Book Awards are pretty interesting, and this is a special thing that they do. I do agree. I would love to see something like this that expands the age group, or even just acknowledges having your debut work of fiction published at any age is a remarkable thing that is still very unlikely to happen for anybody. Just the odds are not in anyone's favor. And so hitting that milestone is an enormous success. It would be interesting to see what other versions of this would look like. I really love the 7 over 70 idea that it's never too late to get started.
No, and I definitely understand, like, part of what's happening here, it's like the MacArthur in micro, which is it's seed corn, right? Trying to give a little extra shine so that they can have a full career and dedicate as much of their time to their art making as they can. Whereas if you're over 70, a lot of the row has been hoed, I'm saying, at that point. I'm not sure it's going to mean you're going to do a whole much more books for your next 50 years. So, but I would like, just from a curation point of view, the 7 over 70 as well. And that would be
the Kent Harif Delia Ephron 7 over 70.
They've aged, but like debuts, that's probably an interesting list. I have to come back and do some research another time. But this happens from time to time. It's less common in fiction. You write a memoir later of your celebrity, wherever. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about
fiction.
Your first novel over 65 or something like that would be interesting. Okay, we're going to do a sponsor break, and I want to get into Barnes & Noble stuff for a minute.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
So this is a piece in, you know, the Times' increasingly broad-based feature writing about the world of books and reading and publishing. The premise of this one, I think, is fascinating because we've danced around saying it quite like this ourselves. It's by Elizabeth A. Harris, who I've shouted out before as being, you know, one. I think her and Alexander Alter are doing most of the sort of beat writing for the industry. We've talked about how I think even, I don't even remember when this happened, but it references something we've talked about before of the anachronism of 1998's You've Got Mail, where Joe Fox and Fox Books is the big bad, right? And real soon after that, interestingly, like in the next 3 years, Amazon came on the scene and Barnes & Noble was taking body blows, and then Borders went out of business, bookstores, is everything going to happen? And we've kind of talked about where this Barnes & Noble is neither the big bad, nor is it on life support. It's in this other stage now, right? It's not going out of business. Rebecca and all of your teenage friends are going right at 3:30 to buy all the books. We heard about this. Your story's over there. And they've been rejuvenating some stores. They've closed some stores. They've moved some stuff around. And this piece says that now Barnes & Noble is the, it's kind of positioning Barnes & Noble as the standard bearer for like regular book selling, which I thought was a fascinating positioning, because not just not a villain, but a hero. It's one thing to say it's no longer a villain, but it's a hero now. And I don't think that's necessarily right. Harris says, you know, where once independent booksellers thought of them as big bad, now they don't. But then doesn't quote any independent booksellers to say that. There's Orrin Tyker, the former head of the ABA, saying it's not as bad anymore. Well, Orrin hasn't been at the charge of the ABA for several years. I know that because he was on Annotated, graciously. Right. She does quote one bookseller who's like, I'd rather not have one down the street from me. Like that's the. So I don't know. So this is partially a call. I know we have independent booksellers that listen to the show and they write us often and they tell stuff about shrink wrap and Atomic Habits. I would like to know from independent booksellers that listen, what's your Q rating on Barnes & Noble right now? And if you don't know what a Q rating is, I don't know what the scale is, but you know what I'm asking. They know what I'm saying. Yeah. Give me a prose description of like, do you think of them as a fellow traveler? Are they the enemy of the enemy is my friend? Are they, yeah, you know what? If it weren't for Barnes & Noble, the rest of this, it would be, it's the keystone in the physical bookselling well in the US. And if someone pulled it out, the rest of it was crumbled. Like, what's your sense of it? Because I don't actually buy this article. I don't buy what they're selling here, what Harris is selling and what Daunt is selling, because we just talked about book sales are up 20% over 2019. Does that have anything to do with Barnes & Noble doing anything better, or you just got a rising tide? That's base case here.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a rising tide. I think that what has gone on here is really the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that Barnes & Noble is not the big bad to independent booksellers, because now independent booksellers need Barnes & Noble sort of to stand between them and Amazon, that if Barnes & Noble falls, then it's really just independent booksellers versus Amazon. And there's, you know, there's Target and Costco and other big box places that sell books. But Barnes & Noble would be the last dedicated brick and mortar chain that in a big sense, you know, and I know that there are other chains, but Barnes & Noble is the big one. I think that's where, I don't know that booksellers would call it a necessary evil. I don't think they perceive Barnes & Noble as an evil. I'm not sure what their perception of it is, as you're saying, especially since she doesn't quote a lot of indie booksellers here. I would guess that the sentiment of, it would be my preference if there's not one directly down the block from my independent bookstore. Like, I don't want to compete with Barnes & Noble, but I prefer that Barnes & Noble continues to compete against Amazon on my behalf, would be my guess. I object to the villain hero model of this anyway. But the idea that just by continuing to exist, Barnes & Noble is somehow like saving publishing, I think books would continue to exist and be sold. The market might contract. It might become more difficult for independent booksellers because Amazon could suck up more of the book buying audience. They, as we have established, have access and the ability to discount books in a way that independent booksellers can't afford to. It puts the squeeze on indies if Barnes & Noble goes out of business. But I don't really know that there's much of a story here.
Well,
I think it's worth saying out loud, like, remember how Amazon is really the story. You know, it's worth just saying out loud, remember how we all used to be worried about Joe Fox and his big chain bookstore, and wasn't that quaint before Amazon came in and disrupted everything? But I don't think that Barnes & Noble has done any. I think Barnes & Noble got lucky this year that the teens got into books on TikTok and want to wander into Barnes & Noble after school and pick up their books. And why they're doing that at Barnes & Noble rather than ordering them from Amazon, I would guess, has to do with, like, they can hop in their cars and go get them. And maybe their parents aren't letting them use credit cards on the internet yet.
Like, could be. Or it's an outing. I mean, it's the same reason we went to Barnes & Noble as teens, right. Rebecca. Not for nothing.
How many, like, I mean, I was nerdy. How many dates did I go on with a high school boyfriend to the Barnes & Noble on the plaza in Kansas City? So many.
With the snow falling and the lights up in November, yes. December. Hot chocolate. It's great stuff.
It was just as good as, like, wandering through the Upper West Side in the fall. Well, to my 18-year-old self, probably.
That's a great point. Barnes & Noble was the Upper West Side to those of us who lived in, like, suburbs and college towns. That was the height of teenage sophistication. It wasn't going to the opera or something like that. It was going to get a caffeinated, over-sugared beverage, right?
Yep.
That was basically a caffeinated liquid Snickers bar, and then going looking at paperback favorites.
It was like the height of sophistication and romance. Yeah. Was like, let's go hold hands and look at hardbound classics and, you know, talk about The Scarlet Letter.
So there's a logical chain that I think we're both tapping into. And I think Daunt has done some good things, and I'll talk about some specifics here, but books were a beneficiary of the pandemic, and yes. People are buying more books. And if you were a bookstore, you did better than you would have thought. And Barnes & Noble is the biggest bookstore chain in America, ergo it ripped most of the benefits. I think that's a pretty uncontrovertible point of view that doesn't really have much to do with individual actions here. The great bookstore theory of the world doesn't really hold in that environment. Now, having said that, I think it was true that the Barnes & Nobles were neglected. You know, it was looking kind of shabby. We were still having the same armchairs and topography from 1995. My favorite little anecdote here is about getting rid of Co-op. Did you catch that little piece?
Yes, I did. I put it on the staff Slack, and Jen and I had a little moment.
Well, tell us about the moment then. What was your little moment about it?
Well, so for listeners who are unfamiliar with the lingo, co-op is the term that describes the practice by which publishers will pay bookstores, including some independent bookstores, but also largely these big chains like Barnes & Noble, to place specific titles in specific places. And historically, that's been like the big octagon table at the front of Barnes & Noble, the like new in fiction shelf, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Indie bookstores will often get co-op for like featuring a title in their newsletter, that sort of stuff. And it's a long-standing practice, as we've talked about it on the show over the years. It has surprised folks to find out that when you wander into Barnes & Noble and you look at the paperback favorites table, some of those titles are there, not because they were curated, but because the publisher paid for them to be there. And that, James Dot notes, they have stopped doing. They have stopped taking money to place titles in high traffic places. And it's like one little nugget in a two sentence thing here where I was like, this is the most interesting thing here. I think it's a big deal.
Yeah.
He notes that they stopped doing it because it meant that the stores often got stuck with a high volume of particular titles that they weren't going to move because of, you know, just the customers in that area weren't interested, but we committed to this and now we got to put 25 of these on this table and they're just going to sit there forever. And when he phrased it that way, I was like, oh, right, that makes sense. Why you wouldn't want to keep doing this anymore. The value proposition of having to actually move those titles meant that they were losing money more than they were gaining from having taken payment for the placements. That was just the moment that Jen and I had, was like, this is a big deal and this is the thing we should be talking about, because publishers have relied on that for placement, for like those are the things, the titles at the front of the store where you're most likely to pick stuff up, were things that they're hoping to have be word of mouth kinds of hits often end up on those tables. And I would pay real American dollars to hear like someone at Penguin Random House talk about how they feel about not being able to pay co-op for Barnes & Noble placement.
Like, does it, I mean, the fundamental question is, did it work? I mean, just because the publishers were doing it and Barnes & Noble was allowing it, doesn't mean it works. It sounds like it wasn't lucrative enough for Barnes & Noble to continue doing it, at the very least. Like, their end of the bargain wasn't getting squared up. On the publisher side, were they seeing an ROI on that kind of stuff? Or is it just something they did? Inertia like this is very difficult to turn around sometimes.
And how would they know? It's that problem of big marketing budgets. If you have a big enough marketing budget to pay co-op for a title to be placed somewhere, you're probably advertising it in all kinds of other places as well. And how they could know that a sale was attributable to this was on the front table. Mm-hmm. At Barnes & Noble is very murky to impossible.
You'd have to do some sort of like A-B test, right? Like, these books didn't get it and this did, and they had a similar marketing budget and it was deployed slightly differently. And I don't know. Like, I think our base case, as we're saying earlier, is you should now attribute more things to people buying more books. And one of the reasons they're buying more books is because of Book Talk, or at least the books they're buying is because of Book Talk. And the other piece I thought was interesting here to talk about the different buying patterns. And I found it to be a little bit of Kremlinology to try to understand what's really changed in the Barnes & Noble buying ecosystem. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the days of, and I can't remember her name, there was a power broker over there.
Cecily Tinsley.
Yeah, Cecily Tinsley. Boy, I would have loved to have done an annotated about her back in the day. But would basically make national buys. Like, talk about a king or queen or royalty maker for a book. If that person, or at Costco, there's someone similar now, though I don't think they were ever as powerful as the Barnes & Noble was, especially back in the Joe Fox days. Because with Joe Fox was real and actually ran Barnes & Noble, Rebecca. but you know what I mean. Like, but those days are gone, and there's a lot more, let's call it, decentralized control over book buying. Mm-hmm. A lot of the corporate staff at Barnes & Noble has been gutted. They say about half the number of people are on corporate staffs. We also know that the staffs of book buyers and booksellers across the board, remember this was pre-pandemic, there was a lot of like the professional full-time booksellers at Barnes & Noble's got laid off in the bad old days. And so there was some cost cutting. There's no question about that. And being given the gift of free advertising in the form of the tsunami of attention and excitement around books on Book Talk, that confluence of COVID-19 and that, I hope they're not saying, look what a great job we've done, because then they're going to make a mistake. They're going to misattribute success to something else. And I don't know what that really looks like. You know, if they're just like, if you have teens coming at 3:30 to buy the books, all you got to do is put them out, because you know what they are, because you see Book Talk too. So it's a different kind of hit making. And again, we see another lament of there hasn't been a big book this year. I'm like, Atomic Habits sold 500,000 copies. Colleen Hoover, she's five of her books are in the top 20, selling 20,000. What do you want? What do you want from her? I don't understand. Talk about looking a gift horse in the mouth. I can't believe it.
And that's just, it's impossible to manufacture or predict.
Impossible.
You know, like what 2022 title is going to be big on TikTok or whatever the thing is 4 years from now.
No.
You just cannot force it to happen. I'm with you. I'm a little bit concerned that Barnes & Noble is benefiting from the combined good luck of these books went big on TikTok and people read more during the pandemic and attributing it to changes that they have made, thinking that it will continue to work. And I guess the inverse of that is the story that's big this week about Netflix losing subscribers for the first time.
That's a great point.
In a decade? It's the first quarter that they've ever lost subscribers. And there's all sorts of conversation about it, but I think you can really sum it up as it's a very crowded field, streaming is right now. And people were Netflix did just fine in the early days of COVID, where all any of us could do was sit around and watch Netflix, and the content didn't have to be very appealing for it to be appealing enough to be like, well, I can't go anywhere else, so I guess I'll watch Tiger King or whatever. But now Netflix is competing against Apple TV Plus and HBO Max, most notably. Those two are really crowding the field. Hulu is doing very well, and Netflix is doing some well, we have ways to shore this up. We're going to have an ad-supported level that'll be cheaper, and we're going to crack down on people sharing their passcodes. Like, that might work for a little while, but it sounds to me like they're not looking at the core problems, the core things that they could do to protect their business against that dip. And I am concerned that we're going to have similar stories about Barnes & Noble, like, hopefully a year from now when we're all out in the world even more than we're able to be right now, which is meaningfully more already than it was 2 years ago, that like I hope that some of this attractiveness of books that people refound or discovered for the first time in COVID sticks around. But you can't count on that. We cannot assume that those patterns of, you know, March 2020 are going to hold forever and build businesses around them. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? And if there's a dip, can they acknowledge that it's something like, oh, people are outside more, or we're competing against all these other forms of entertainment again, or maybe like something happens with TikTok and the kids stop talking about books and they start talking about something else. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Or is the business still going to be okay?
I think the Netflix comparison is super interesting for this reason, which is people aren't, if the TikTok hypothesis is true, people aren't going to Barnes & Noble because it's Barnes & Noble. It's because that's where they can go get the Colleen Hoover or the Circe or whatever, right? And that's just the receptacle. That's just the middleman, right? And it's the book itself and then the hype around the book itself that's driving them to go get the thing. Netflix has the same problem. People don't care about Netflix. They care about Severance. They care about Succession. They care about shows. And if you don't got the goods, they don't care. They're going to lose. Not for nothing, Netflix also hiked its price in the last quarter. I didn't see any coverage of that. It's like, people, you hike the price, you lose subscribers. It's just going to happen in Russia and everything else. But like, I don't care about Netflix. I also don't care about HBO. I care about Stranger Things, and I care about Pachinko, and I care about Hacks when it comes back on May 12th.
Yeah, yes,
you know,
goodness.
I care about Atlanta, and I'm going to go seek those things out. And if you don't have the thing, I'm going to cancel the thing. And if you don't have the interesting thing about books is that they're omni-channel. You can get Colleen Hoover in a bunch of different places. What are you doing to protect? That's the place you go to get. If Book Talk sticks around, and I'm to the point where I hope it, I mean, I hope it does. I hope this kind of enthusiasm, and I hope it, this is great for books. And I hope people read them and continue to buy them. And I would it kill us to have a few non-white people get the bump and be in the top 20? No, it wouldn't. That's a place I would like to see change. But what's Barnes & Noble going to do? Or can they just be sit there and basically collect rent on Book Talk enthusiasm? It's not the time for a Barnes & Noble is now a hero. I hope we're not reading our press here too much about this. I thought the whole thing was fascinating, and it really crystallized some of the stuff that's in the air about, wait, how do we feel about Barnes & Noble now? And what is going on? Did they right the ship? Or did a different hurricane blow them in the direction they should be sailing? I'm just not sure about that at this particular point. Do we want to do front list foyer for a minute, or
let's
what do you want to do?
A little.
Okay,
yeah,
you go
do
first.
A little front list foyer. I was traveling over the weekend, so I went looking into my pile of galleys in my iPad, and I read a great little like literary family novel called Marrying the Ketchups by Jennifer Close. I have enjoyed some of her previous books. She wrote one of them was called The Smart One. That's Rumana Lam. Anyway, look up Jennifer Close. I'm not Googling it right now, but Marrying the Ketchups, I think, is coming out April 26th. So by the time you're listening to this show, it will be out or almost out. And it's set in Chicago about a family that own a restaurant. They are diehard Cubs fans. The patriarch of the family died just before the Cubs won the World Series in 2016. And we get the rotating perspectives of several of the adult children and of his widow. Both in the aftermath of the 2016 election and then the Cubs winning. And then like one of the daughters moves home from New York and is working back at the family restaurant. And another of the kids has been working at another restaurant, finds himself coming back to the family restaurant. And there's just, you know, the exact type of family drama that you would expect there to be. I really enjoyed it. I love a like complex family dynamics story. It was perfect plain reading, which I think is that, like, this should be a category in the bookstore.
Yeah.
It's like things that are great to read on vacation. And that is the opposite of a pejorative. Like, you have to be compelling enough to keep me engaged. Like, I got to be interested from page one so that I can tune out all the stuff that's happening around me on the plane. It cannot be like too, it can't be dry. It can't be like too thinky. It takes real skill to write a book that is well written and really fun and engaging to read. And I really loved it. I thought for what it was really good. Our pal Greg Zimmerman mentioned it on his Instagram as like, if you were a fan of the most, I think it was called The Most Fun We Ever Had, which is a big family novel a few years ago, that this would be a good fit. And I did really like that novel. I think I also read that because of Greg's recommendation.
Big so shouts Mary to Zimmerman today. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Greg writes a book blog called I think he still posts
at
the New Dork. Yeah. The New Dork Review of Books. And he was one of the OG Book Riot contributors. I think he still listens to the show. So thanks for recommending that to me, Greg. Mm. And then I'm almost finished with Crying in the Bathroom by Erica L. Sanchez, which is a memoir in essays that comes out in July. It's really fun.
I'm listening to Left on 10th. I'm halfway through. I extend my evening walk by like 45 minutes to do it.
How many times have you gotten misty?
Well, I was a little more prepared than you were because you didn't read the back. I mean, shouts to you. no shots, but shouts to
Boldly
you.
Boldly going.
So I knew a little bit more what I was in for. So I was steeled. It's great. I mean, I could listen to it forever. I could listen to Delia Ephron or Nora Ephron narrate their personal literary, I guess this is Greenwich Village, not Upper West Side, but it's kind of all in the same ballpark of erudition and personality and a little bit of a sharp elbow, but also some warmth at the same time. Kind of always wanted to be an Ephron, I guess it's just the truth of it to some degree. Wonderful on audio, heartbreaking, warm. Interesting counterpoint to Heartbreak by Florence Williams. Mm-hmm. It's not unlike, you know, you lose a spouse, you're heartbroken, you're dealing with pain. What do you do? It's nice if you fall into your own You've Got Mail story in the middle of it. It turns out that's a nice a balm for the injured and grieving and ailing soul, as a word. So I could listen to it forever. I hope it never ends, I know there are only 2 hours and 47 minutes left. Not that I'm counting. I did Sea of Tranquility in one sitting over the weekend.
Oh, okay.
It's legit. I guess we're straddling the seasons show title where we now, no, both Egan and the Mandel came out in April. I'm sorry, it's still April. Mm-hmm. Sea of Tranquility debuted at number 2 on the hardcover frontlist fiction list, 20,000 copies, destroying her last, nice, The Glass Hotel. Also even really outpacing Station 11 when the show came out. So I think the confluence of the reviews have been very good, and I'll just say deservedly so. It's spec fic. I don't want to spoil it. I think you go in, you like literary fiction, you like speculative fiction. If you're into the Station 11 thing, I think there's a chance this is my most recommendable book of the year. Right at this point, it's my,
okay,
just because it hits a lot of the quadrants, Rebecca, and you're going to read it, and we're going to, I think, talk about it in some format in the future. But I can see why they chose to adopt it. Oh, that reminds me of a listener email. It's a super juicy one, and they didn't want me to talk about their names, except someone who was involved in a TV show, and I'll say no more than this. We asked about how unusual is this to have a durable relationship between a creative team, showrunners, and an author, like a multi-book thing. And this person said, I'm not really sure, but I have an experience with an author as being a part of a thing. And let me just tell you that this person's behavior, if it's anything indicative of what authors are like on the set of a show they really don't actually have any more creative control over, you don't want them. It was not a great look. It did not help. It did not say, I want to sign up for a 3-book deal to produce more of this person's shows. Very dishy. I appreciate that email to no end. Thank you. You know who you are if you wrote that. I will say no more about it. I will forward it to you, Rebecca.
I'm going to need all the details.
Yeah, I'll forward it. I meant to forward it to you, but I kind of wanted to have the fun of springing on you without knowing, but you can get the details later. So 20,000 copies. Candy House debuted with 12,000 copies.
Okay.
So selling pretty well. I think Sea of Tranquility has legs, as we talked about. Candy House, plus one, I read this and recommending to other people, I think is going to be less than one. I think with Sea of Tranquility, people like the book. It's very recommendable. It's going to make a really interesting series. I'd be interested to see if Somerville and the team do they diverge? Is that like their move? Like how much are they going to change? It's pretty damn tight, I will say, as a book right now. So you're going to read this, I know, eventually, so I won't say much more about it right now. My last one, I actually read this earlier, and I think I just missed it in wanting to talk about it, but Joan Is Okay by Weiqi Wang. Her first book was called Chemistry. Fascinating book. It's more of a character study than anything. The main character is a doctor who's, I think, maybe supposed to, I don't know. My read of that, she's on the spectrum in some capacity, though it's never said out loud. It's not the main topic, but written from her point of view and the way she's interacting with people and is picking up on things and not picking up on things suggests maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. That's more of a interpretation than on the tin. But she is the child of Chinese immigrants, working her fanny off at St. Vincent's, which is the Greenwich Village, the big Greenwich Village hospital. trying to make her way in the world, trying to figure out what she wants and who she is. And then COVID happens, and how that crystallizes and throws into relief the cracks in her own relationships with her family, what she does and doesn't have going on in her personal life. It's a little gem of a literary portrait, and I thought it was an indelible achievement to try to convey a worldview, right, of this particular person. There's not much plot. You know, it's someone living their life. It's literary fiction in that way. Sometimes people bang on that. But the truth is, that's how most of our lives work, right? Is that there's not a big story. There's not a big plot. It's just us doing the best we can. And this is someone doing the best they can and trying to figure out even what that looks like when they are who they are and they have the family they have and their experience is different and they want different things than their family does. And I don't know. She's a really exciting writer.
I'm sold.
I think a PhD student in chemistry. I don't think she's a doctor herself, right? I don't remember, but she's a scientist by trade. And then that lead me to another book, and I think I just got algorithmized this, Portrait of a Thief by Grace Liu, and the blurb was like Ocean's 11.
Ooh.
I was like, okay, I'm in.
I'm listening.
And the prompt is there's a heist where a bunch of Chinese art is stolen out of the Harvard Art Museum, and it's part of this larger conversation of like, do you really, should you really have that in your museum, Boston, Harvard? Shouldn't this be maybe in Shanghai or some other place? You know, it's Elgin Marble is part of that. But basically, because of who the initial point of view character is, he becomes a suspect. He's a Chinese student. Mm. He's studying art history. He was kind of around the crime at the time. And then I don't think it's written well enough to really recommend. It's funny. There was a particular line that struck me that also then when I look back at Publishers Weekly point, I was like, this is fun, but there's some writing stuff here and I'm looking forward to the next one. But it's, I like an art heist book. What can I say? It was a pretty quick read. Also appeared at the bottom of the New York Times bestseller list in hardcover front list fiction. I did it on ebook. That was pretty interesting too. I think that's all the things I've been reading.
You've been busy.
I tell you what, Project Frontlist has been a wild success when it comes to page read.
Seriously, I remember reading Chemistry by Wakey Wang in one sitting, like on a Saturday afternoon, and being like, this is a voice I want to hear more of. So I'm really excited to, to pick up Jonah's Okay. And I think I might have to look at Portrait of a Thief.
You know, read a sample on your Kindle. Get for the first couple of chapters. If you're in, you're in. If you're out, you're out. Like I've said this before to a friend recently, there are two kinds of books to me now. There's books I'm into and not into. Those are the only two. Those are only two kinds of books that I care about. And sometimes I'll get through a book I'm not into for reasons, but I'm really trying to abandon stuff I'm not into. There's too many books I can get into to waste, not waste time, but to like, that's not how I use my
life is too short.
Wild and precious 20 minutes between feeding the kids and my call starting.
Yes. Mary Oliver would approve.
Yes. Thank you much, Mary Oliver. That's all I really need to know. You can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. You can email us podcast@bookriot.com. Find the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. Our summer preview draft is available there. You can download it at the middle tier. There's some other tiers available to you. Check those out. And Rebecca, we'll talk to you real soon.
All right. Have a good one.